What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Keith Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff to German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I am your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic, Rockfin, Odyssey, probably not YouTube, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you very much. We certainly do appreciate your attention. We know you have a million choices out there. And a great big thank you to our sponsors, the amazing C60 Purple Power. We can't do it without them. Ken Schwartz, the scientist behind this. He is he's an interesting fella. Came over to my house and we talked about aliens for like an hour. It was great. And he explained to me the process of how you make C60. Not that I understand it any better. It's very complicated. It sounds super expensive, but I'm glad Ken is making it and not me. If you are interested, C60 is a naturally occurring molecule comprised of 60 carbon atoms forming something that looks like a hollow soccer ball. It is a what they call a free radical sponge. It has the ability to neutralize free radicals and reset itself again and again. It is the most powerful antioxidant known. It's hundreds of times more powerful than anything out there. It may also help provide you cellular protection against many toxic environmental factors. It's definitely going to help maximize the efficiency of your cells in producing energy. Disclaimer, it's not been approved by the FDA, but then again, we know that the FDA is a shakedown operation, so I wouldn't be overly concerned about that, considering that it is made in the United States. It is made with 100% certified organic oils. It is certified for purity, quality, and concentration. And even though it isn't approved by the FDA, it is produced in an FDA-compliant GMP-certified facility. And on top of that, you'll get free shipping on all orders inside the United States. So go to c60purplepower.com, use the promo code MACRO. Save yourself some money, but just go there and check it out. Read a little bit about it. See if you think it's a good fit. See if you like what they're doing. I've been taking it for a couple of months now. I feel great. My cat has been taking it. She looks great too. It's working. I don't know what to tell you. Also, if you've lived through 2020 and you thought, nah, I don't need to get prepared for any of this. This is all totally normal. Well, you need to have your head examined. And you might want to consider going to My Patriot Supply, to their website, Prepare with Macroaggressions, where we have an offer for you. You can get a 4-week supply of emergency food, or you can get a 3-month supply, free shipping inside the United States. Go ahead and take a look, check it out. My God, get yourself prepared somewhere. If it's not through this website, then at least have the foresight to start stocking up on cans of food and maybe some bags of rice and start thinking about getting yourself prepared, because we know it's coming. we know Uncle Klaus has told us that the supply chain disruptions are coming. So it's kind of up to us if we want to pretend like he doesn't know what he's talking about. I think he does. So anyway, now that we've got the business sorted out, you know, we had an episode a couple of weeks ago with Ian Webster in Australia, and that was called The Nightmare at Nearcool. That was a story about Australian care homes and from the 1800s all the way through the 1970s. This one in particular, it was like a death camp. Kids were being sent there from Aboriginal kids from the United Kingdom were sent there, and also kids from just foreign countries, just blindly shipped off to these places that were run by nuns. And it wasn't until decades later that they uncovered what was actually happening there. And the reason why this kind of got on my radar was because I'd heard about the things that Kevin Annett had talked about what had been happening in Canada and the Canadian schools and things like that. And so it's been fresh in my mind. So it's interesting that our guest is no stranger to the show. It's Darren Grimes, everybody, one half of Grimerica joining us. How are you doing, Darren?
Well, I'm pretty good.
You're pretty
I think
good.
I'm the better half.
I think you're the better half.
Half of Grimerica, yeah.
As far as you know. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
the audience seems to normally side with Graham, but I don't let that get me down.
And you shouldn't. You shouldn't. They
don't know what they're talking about.
They will be made to understand. They will be made to understand. And I think it's interesting that you, as a Canadian, as an Indian, you have taken this work quite seriously. It's a serious topic. And you have a book out, A Canadian Shame, The Ongoing Legacy of the Indian Act and Residential Schools. And what interesting timing that you've come out with this and that we're going to talk about it, given that I've just been on this subject recently. It's disgusting. And I think that maybe people don't, you know, maybe there's some part of people that don't want to really think about it because it's so disgusting. But I don't know that's the best solution. I don't think that solves any of the problems. Growing up in Canada, was this sort of thing known, are we getting a look at what was happening behind the scenes about the same time you guys are getting this?
No, well, I mean, some people knew, but lots of the Indians knew. I didn't know. I mean, most Canadians didn't know. I grew up off reserve, so it wasn't in any of our school programs or anything like that. You know, we were just taught the very peaceful, we got along, the Americans went to war, we didn't, we had a good thing, you know?
Yeah.
And everybody's happy. I mean, that's kind of what you learn in public school anyway. And I go to a public school that's very much, you know, in the middle of Anishinaabe territory. So it's interesting where there's a ton of people wandering around that are the fallout from those institutions. Mm-hmm. Like the homelessness is high. And when we were a kid, we weren't taught anything, but you know, that's just how Indians act, you know?
Yeah, we got that. I grew up in Southern California in an area, Palm Springs, that had like a lot of Indian tribes there. And I remember growing up with this family that it was the only exposure I ever had to Native Americans, as we call them. And I remember just thinking, like, where did they all go? You know, like, what happened? You know, not knowing like the dark history of this. And as you get older and you start to sort of, you know, you just say, oh, well, eventually I'll meet some more Indians. I never have. They're not really here in the United States. What's the relationship between like the state and the Indians in Canada? Is it reservation? Is everybody's corralled into the reservations and sort of treated poorly? Or you guys, or your ancestors, your people, treated with a little bit more respect than the Native Americans are?
Well, it kind of depends on the thing. I mean, technically, I think the accepted term right now in Canada is Indigenous. I call myself an Indian for political reasons because I still have a card in my wallet that says I'm a registered Indian. They did change the name of the department, I think. Now, so it depends. I mean, I think it's like, there's about a third, I want to say, off the top of my head, a third or so that are on reserve. I think there's about 500,000 registered Indians. And then there's about 1.5 million or so of the just people identifying as Indigenous.
Okay. And that would be you?
No, I'm registered Indian.
Oh, registered. Okay.
Yeah, I'm registered from, I don't know the treaty number, but I'm from Mishkilgaming, number 203, Ojibwe Nation in Northern Ontario.
Even though you don't live in Northern Ontario?
No. I could go to live there, and I think I'd get, like, they'd figure out some housing for me.
Okay.
I probably wouldn't have to pay for it. But I would never own the land. So, I mean, that doesn't really work for me.
Yeah.
In order to own the land, you get a leave reserve. Or the federal government just owns the land. So the federal government, the crown, whoever you want to call it, holds the land in trust for us. But now, like right now, I'm fighting to get my kids their status cards. And that's coin toss on whether or not that's going to happen. If I'm able to pull that off, it'll be highly unlikely that they're able to pull it off there for their kids. Mm-hmm. The only way they'd be able to pull it off for their kids if they were, it would be if they were able to marry another status Indian, mm-hmm. which could happen. And then their kid would probably get it too. So my grandkids could get it that way. But if not, I would say the chances are slim to none. Like I say, right now, it's a probably less than 50% chance I'm going to pull it off for them. And that's with me being a treaty Indian and their mom is also a Métis. So we'll see. I mean, right now it's in my band which is what we call the tribes in Canada, is fighting for their rights in the courts. So we'll see how that pans out. Me, I don't let it really stop me. I still take them hunting. They can still hunt. They can still fish. I still let them exercise the rights the same as I exercise mine. And if, you know, that comes to a head, then it will defer to me anyway at this point, because they're still young enough that it defers to me for another like 6 years or 7 years. So mm-hmm. until then, I'm willing to just, okay, I'll see you in court type thing is my attitude.
Gotcha.
On that. The moral of the story is that your 500 or 600,000 registered Indians in Canada is say 30 years away from maybe cutting in half, and then another 30 years away from cutting in half again. So it's a long game plan to just get that land back in the end. And that's where it's like, that's not really good enough. It's time to figure something out here where there's a sort of definitive decision on some land where it's not in the federal government's trust anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever you can get it out of the federal government's decision-making powers, you're probably in better shape. They, did you guys have the same sorts of issues that the Native Americans and American Eskimos had, which is a disposition towards alcoholism and things like that? It seemed like in America they were introducing things like alcohol to a group of people that had no relationship with it, and it was hitting them disproportionately harder than it was hitting other ethnic groups. Did you guys have I don't think that was
accidental. Yeah, there's some of that, but it's also, you got to remember those groups were also being disproportionately traumatized at that time and ever since. I mean, and it's not so, because the alcoholism lines up with the suicide too. Like some of the different rates in suicide, especially with the Inuit, are like 40-1 compared to non-Inuit in that sort of age group. And that's that same group that has problems with alcoholism and drug abuse and everything else. And it's because you're now, you know, you're now, what, 5-6 generations into having kids ripped away from their homes, living in well below poverty conditions in a lot of cases. Once the residentials were schools were over, it rolled over into child welfare, which is a problem that they still face today. We just had last month was the first time in history that a Canadian Indian band has got control of their own child welfare system. That's the first time that's ever happened in Canada. Whoa. Where they will decide what kids need to be taken out of homes and they will decide where those kids go, which up until now has been, you know, off the reserve, away from Indians and into white families for the most part. I mean, for the most part, to the point that I'm not just saying stuff, to the point that the, you know, three different premiers of Canada have publicly apologized for their government's roles in the taking of kids for off reserve through child welfare and dispersing them all over North America. There was advertisements in the newspapers. I've got a few advertisements in the book from the newspapers back in the 60s and 70s with advertisements for Indian kids.
What do you mean advertisements for Indian kids? Like you could buy them?
Well, no, you just get them like up for adoption. So there's a waiting list for white kids, but if you want an Indian kid, you could have them tomorrow.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, well, to the point that like a bunch of kids, there was a few Indian fellas, Cree guys that ended up back here just in the Trump, when Trump was president and he was starting to do sort of the crackdown along the border, There was at least one or two Cree fellas that had only just found out they were Cree. They thought they were Mexican most of their lives. Mm-hmm. And he actually ended up coming back to Canada because you don't have papers now. So none of these kids that ended up in the States have proper documentation. Ooh. So he was worried that if the Border Patrol shows up at his place, he looks brown.
Yeah.
He's Indian and he doesn't have proper documentation to be in the country. He's got some weird adoption paper was all he really had. So he ended up having to come back to Canada where it worked out for, I can't remember his name. I should know his name if I'm going to mention him this much, but he ended up coming back to Canada and sort of falling back with his roots and stuff like that. I mean, what's left of him? I mean, I still haven't been to my reserve. I've been talking to my chief the last couple of months, trying to get out there. Maybe with COVID, it's been tough. But I'm hoping either this fall or next spring to get out and start. I mean, I don't really plan to live there, but I'd like to go check it out. And I mean, I don't think I need to live there. I think the fact that I don't live there and I'm sort of immersed in this world leaves me in a unique opportunity to sort of get the information out.
Yeah.
As opposed to not, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I think I'm really glad that you wrote this book. We were talking about hopelessness and suicide rates and alcoholism and all these things. Listen, there's good reason to be despondent because of this. Some of the things in your book that you talk about, reasons that broke apart these tribes, ban of religious ceremonies, ban of Indians leaving reserves without Indian agent permission, inability of Indians to vote, mandatory residential schools, prohibition of alcohol and ammunition. Like, no wonder everybody is so despondent. They're taking away their religion. They're taking away schools. They're creating mandatory residential schools.
Residential schools where it's illegal to speak your native tongue.
And that too. So who, this sounds, only the Crown could come up with something as psychotic as this, right?
Well, it would seem to be a combination of the, well, I mean, the British was involved, but when the Indian Act technically comes into play is under the Canadian government. So at that time, I mean, the Canadian government's still heavily in bed with the Crown. It's no longer the Dominion of Canada, though. Now it's become Canada.
Okay.
And yeah, and then the other problem is the church, a bunch of churches, you know, the Anglican, the Catholic, the Presbyterian, the United, mostly. Now, I don't have the stats in front of me. I could find them quick, but it was, mostly the Catholic and the Anglican, I want to say. I could find out. I'll look that up quick while we're talking.
So they, so you, so the church is heavily involved.
Yeah, the church ran the school. So the schools were church run.
And these,
so the government paid for them and the church ran them.
Okay. And these residents, and when did this, like, what, give us a kind of a timeline. When did this sort of start?
The, so that would probably be like in the early 1800s, you start seeing the Anglican and Methodist doing missionary schools.
Okay.
But it was still like only because, I mean, you got to remember there's also a, there's also a bit of a desire from some communities or some families to start learning some of this stuff because it's starting to become very clear that, you know, that the way of life is going to change. Yeah. So, so you have some of this stuff where it's happening voluntarily in the early 1800s. By 1885, they become, mandatory. 1884.
Okay.
So now you have to, you don't have a choice. Once you're six, they come get you. They bang on the door. The Mounties will come. Whoever will come, they come take the kid away. And you go, if you have a brother or sister, you get sort of split up and you get taken to these schools.
This is, it's insanity.
Yeah. And then, I mean, some kids got to go home for the summer. Some kids don't. Some kids went to, like, say, work on a farm for the summer or something like that. But in a lot of cases, so now, I mean, these kids get taken at such an age that maybe by the time they go home a couple of years later, there's a ton of stories of kids that go home and they can't even speak the language anymore.
Oh.
So their parents don't speak English or French in some cases, or if they do, it's very, very limited. And the kids can't speak their native tongue anymore.
That's devious.
So now, and then not only that, you've got nuns and other church folks sort of telling these kids that the shit their parents doing is pagan bullshit. If their parents are doing any sort of these potluck ceremonies or any powwows or anything like that, that, you know, that's not okay. That's summoning demons. So these kids are just going back into their communities broken, isolated. I mean, that's the number one thing you hear in the stories, I would say, is when they get to the schools, they feel isolated. And I mean, that's even when you get into the generations where it was like, maybe the kids were wanted to go, or maybe the kids didn't want to go, but their parents did. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, there was instances of that. It took them a while to sort of figure out what was going on, and it wasn't all the schools. And then I think by the 70s, we took them back. Early 70s, we started taking them back. So those same schools would still run till 1996, but they would be run by Indians.
Okay. Did things get better?
Well, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. It wasn't. I mean, it was by the, I mean, I would say things started really getting better after World War II. By the mid to late 40s, definitely by the early 50s, I had a ton, you had a couple thousand indigenous people go serve in the war. Mm-hmm. So at that time, that's when you can't easily travel between reserves without a pass, stuff like that. So you've had these communities basically in isolation for 50 years, for a couple generations. And, they finally got to talk to each other, maybe compare scenarios and chat a bit over when they were overseas. Mm-hmm. And then the interesting thing is then they'd come back and they wouldn't be allowed in the... We have the Legion system in Canada, the Royal Canadian Legion, which is where all the veterans hang out. Mm-hmm. But Indians couldn't go there because you're not allowed to drink. They serve alcohol. But the other big thing that World War II did is it sort of woke people up to human rights.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, the Holocaust, whatever happened there, either way, it woke a lot of people up to human rights, which had people starting to look in their own back door.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, still, I mean, it's still the 40s, 50s, 60s aren't great. I mean, it's not great now, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. Well, these residential schools that where we start to find bodies piling up, 215 bodies at Kamloops Indian Residential School. That's the one that I think a lot of people have heard about recently. 109 bodies at Brandon Indian Residential School, 751 bodies at Maryville Indian Residential School. This is alarming, to say the least. What is happening here? What sort of genocide is this? This is crazy.
Well, I think in a lot of cases, those graves probably used to be marked.
Okay.
And for whatever reason, they're not now. Maybe they never were, but I think when the church moved out or whenever moved out or there was no upkeep, I don't know enough about what happened. And I think that, you know, most of those kids probably died of tuberculosis. As early as 1907, Dr. Bryce was doing reports before 1907, really, about how the death rate in the residential schools was anywhere between 25 and 50%, about how they were putting after a sick kid died, they'd throw a not sick kid in the same bed with the same sheets, everything else. Once a kid got sick, they just sort of got crammed in the corner and left to die. You know, you hear this in report after report after report after report. There's a bunch of studies that are quoted in the book about the death rate from tuberculosis being like, I think, 5 to 7 times in the schools what it was on the reserve.
Whoa.
Which, because the thing at the time was that they were saying, well, Indians just have a natural susceptibility to tuberculosis, which there seems to be some truth to. But it's still, you know, magnitudes more than it was on the reserve, where you're not living in cramped conditions and you're with your family and you're eating properly. You know, I think at one time the budget for feeding those kids was like 11 cents per day per kid.
Jeez.
Yeah, and they're working half the time. So after grade 4, you're expected to work half the day. So the schools were expected to be self-sustaining through a certain degree, you know, be able to get your own firewood, stuff like that.
You've got the International Tribunal for the Disappeared of Canada coming out saying residential schools used as a breeding ground for infectious disease that is then disseminated through the natives. So do we think that they were using the residential schools as a breeding ground? Did they just say, oh, well, you know, this is a good way to get rid of some of these kids? Or
Kevin certainly does. And in Kevin's defense, he's been saying they were going to find bodies for a long, long time. I mean, he's been looking for bodies for 20 years.
Yeah.
But and now his concern now is that, A, these bodies weren't supposed to get found. And B, that they're going to use this as an opportunity to find a couple of thousand graves and say that's the end of it. And they've kind of actually quietly in the last 20 years been cleaning up as much as they can. Now, including that, that's what was happening in Kamloops when somebody spilled the beans. Now, I don't get into any of that in the book. I don't disagree with Kevin on a lot of things. I've actually got a chat with him again tomorrow night about some stuff. I quote him in the book a few times. Yep. But, I mean, you talked about the timing for the book, and it's free on Kindle right now until Friday. I don't know if this probably won't come out before then, but it's free this week on Kindle. Just to get it out kind of as far as I can, because the timing is kind of important. People are paying attention. If you look at Canada right now, there's a bunch of people trying to learn about this shit as quickly as possible. And that kind of presents an opportunity to make. So that's one prong of it. And the other prong is that people kind of aren't trusting the government and are disillusioned with the governments on a higher level than I even thought fucking possible, to be perfectly So in my lifetime, I never thought people would be as disillusioned with the government as they are in my ever as they are right now.
Yeah.
And add that on to the fact that they're paying attention to indigenous problems. And I think it's a good time to throw information up. Like I've started another podcast with my buddy Kyle Delisle. He's a Mohawk Indian in Quebec. And it's called The Indian in the Room. Mm-hmm. We started recording that. We're working on the Mohawk creation story right now. It's really cool. She's like going back from just doing it in Mohawk to English. That's how she's translating it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's going to be pretty cool. So we're doing that to try and get as much information out as we can. That's why I figured it was a good time to get the book out to try and like push that ball over while people are, I mean, I'd love to see some major successions from the federal government to everybody. But in general, it's time, in my opinion, and some people disagree with me, but it's time to probably figure out something that works better than the Indian. I don't know what that looks like, but it involves a bunch of people. I don't have the answers. I don't have any of the answers, and I'm not a spokesman for anybody.
Right.
I'm just trying to get the information out there while people seem to be willing to pay attention and while I seem to be uniquely positioned to get information out. Man, it's important to me because, you know, my kids are going to grow up in this shit and it's important to, you know, maybe we can push this ball over the finish line where we can see some real resolution, where we can see some real reconciliation and where we can move forward, in some capacity at least. I mean, there's a lot of land in Canada. We can figure something out. And things have sort of been swinging in that direction. You look at the Alaskas and your Alaska natives in your country,
yep,
have swung a pretty good deal for themselves. You know, and some Alaskans complain, but for the most part, everyone's okay with it. And the tribes are doing well, very well for themselves. They've got a bunch of land. I mean, some people might disagree with me on this too, because there are some ways that the corporations are set up there that you could say that the land is vulnerable. But I have to assume that they know their business. It's not my, I mean, this has been the problem with fucking the crown and the state forever, is their paternal relationship with Indians. So it's not my business to say how the Alaska tribe should handle their business. Right. But I'll say they seem to have handled it well compared to most people. And I would say you'd see the same thing in Canada, you know, in the last 20 years. Is it the last 20? When did Nunavut become a thing? And I mean, that's basically where the Inuit have created a province that they now are the majority government in, because they're the majority people in that province. So they, you know, stood up to the point where they got the federal government to concede and give them a portion of the country, of the Northwest Territories. It would be directly above Manitoba, and it's a bunch of the Arctic Circle and everything else. But they created another territory. And now if anyone can live in the territory, it's not an Indian territory. Charlie Murt, well, you might have trouble because you're an American and you look right. Like trouble. I'd give you some grief if you came to my border crossing.
Yeah.
but any Canadian could move there. Any Canadian citizen could move to Nunavut. There's 38,000 people in the entire 2.093 million square kilometers.
Jesus.
Under 40,000 people. But a lot of this is up above Greenland and shit. You know what I mean? Like the top of their territory is level with Greenland, and the bottom of their territory is halfway up Hudson's Bay. But it's like, now I don't have the exact demographics in front of me, but it's like 70 or 80 or 90% Inuit. So the government is Inuit. So when there's issues, stuff like that, it tends to, you know, they get their say. Like they've done a thing. I think right now they've got grade 1 to 4 or something like that is actually in their native tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes into English from there. But it's a start, you know. But, you know, maybe that's a solution where, because in the States, that's how it is. I believe, you know, Indian land is a nation.
Yeah.
all intents and purposes. That's why they can have their casinos and stuff like that. I don't know the ins and outs of the American system. I barely know the it's so fucking complex and convoluted and made to be that way that I don't know the ins and outs of anything, to be honest. But I'm trying to figure it out because it's important and I want to figure it out for the kids. But, you know, maybe that's one way to do it. You know, we've got these massive land masses in Canada, which honestly, I've been saying forever that I'd like to see just dissolve into smaller chunks. I'd like to see Canada break up into the provinces.
Okay.
And maybe further than that. So if we can have a Nunavut, maybe we can chop Ontario up into a couple smaller pieces. And, you know, the portions of it that are majority Indigenous are going to end up with majority Indigenous governments, and the ones that aren't. And the ones that maybe will end up 50-50, it'll be more democratized though. So we won't have these things where you've got a bunch of Indian reserves up in the north of Ontario. And then you've got Southern Ontario that's, you know, got fucking 20 million people within fucking 20 minutes of Toronto. You know what I mean? Where they're never going to get anywhere. And in Winnipeg, you got the same thing. Now you're going to have a closer ratio in Winnipeg, but now you got the giant city where, you know, 3 out of every 4 people that live in Manitoba live in this city. So, you know, it's hard to get things done. So, but maybe that's a way to do it, that everybody can sort of win. I mean, again, I would argue that's, in some ways, it'd be making it more convoluted, but it gets us down into smaller pieces anyway, which I think is better for fucking everybody involved.
We've got some people we'll be willing to give you if you'd like them. Like, we can clear out large percentages of our major cities and we can just ship them somewhere far away.
We don't need people. But I mean, that might be a way to do it. You know, take the provinces and split them up into smaller chunks where you got more territories. And you could try and split them up so that some of those territories are split up more to serve, so that the governments will be more representative of the cultures in that area. I mean, right now, I think there's like 1 or 2 Indians in the entire Parliament of Canada.
Whoa, that's, yeah, well, I mean, if you guys have underrepresentation, but even now, I think after what we've gone through with COVID and everything, a lot of just traditional, let's just call them white people, feel unrepresented as well. It feels like the insane people are in charge of all of this. But you mentioned your book coming out at like a good time. I think it is a good time because over the last year, with people being kind of forced into their homes against their will in some cases, most cases, it made them think, well, this is like a form of house arrest. I can't even leave my neighborhood. This is kind of like being on a reservation. And then it makes them think, well, I don't like how this feels right now. And I've got Netflix and, you know, central heat, you know, I wonder how this makes.
Well, look how much everyone gets upset when they start talking about just hinting at maybe the state owns your kids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's obviously not anywhere near the same of what the
So that's, I think that's kind of the other point, that reason there's good timing, because I mean, we're at a unique point where everybody's going to be the Indian right away.
Yeah.
Where
you really feel like what it might be like.
Papers to get out of the country. And we're going to start segregating by vaccinated or not vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're just, you know, and I'm just, it's not a good idea to trust the fucking state. I'm telling you. I mean, You can ask any fucking Indigenous person in Canada where fucking trusting the federal government has got them. Or, I mean, you could just take a look at the original treaties and tell me how the fuck that worked out.
Yeah. And same in the United States too. It's like, this doesn't work well when you put the American government, any government really, but in my case, the American government in charge of your camps, you wind up with what you get now, which is high tendencies of alcoholism, suicide, and despondent, you know, just a culture of sadness. And then the only thing, you know, Americans will look, they'll say, well, can't we just stick a casino there? And it's like, God, like, really, is that the only thing that we think of when we think of Native Americans, is can I put a casino there? I mean, it's crazy and disrespectful, but yet I have seen some of the tribes that are local in, well, where I grew up in Southern California, they actually did go ahead and take the casino options, and they've become incredibly wealthy because of that. And then have taken that, that wealth and used it to try and help their people. So
not only that, I mean, there's a bunch of those tribes that are buying up land like crazy, which was what I would argue is the fucking best thing to do.
Yeah.
Is to buy up land, because now, you know, you're just, even if you have to pay tax on that land, you're just, I mean, honestly, because at the end of the day, that's, I think, how we get it back. If we can get some sort of settlement where maybe we get some of the reserve land, which, I mean, let's be honest, are 10% of what they were supposed to be, what their original treaties said they were going to be. But, you know, and maybe that's how it's got to be negotiated. I won't be at that negotiation, I don't think. I can almost guarantee I won't be. I shouldn't be. I don't belong there. I've got no place there. But that might be an idea where you get a percentage of that land and then you get a bunch of money and then you use a bunch of that money to start buying up whatever fucking land is for sale.
Yeah.
Because the money's just going to get burned up otherwise, but the land will always sort of be there.
Yeah.
But again, that would be sort of a by nation decision, which is how it should be, which is probably, you know, why I sort of lean towards that's how there's too many fucking people and we're too spread out to be running this sort of shit. You know, I come from a culture that's more of a few thousand people, comprised of a couple of dozen bands that are only meeting up a few times a year.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there a strategy or is there an opportunity? Would it be smarter for all of the tribes to come together collectively?
There is a collective. There is a couple of movements in Canada that are collective, but it's got to be looser than the affiliation that, say, the federal government has over Canada. You know what I mean? You're going to have a hard time getting, you know, it's like, there is a couple of different acronyms. I don't have them in front of me, but there is a couple of different networks of the bands of Canada sort of congregating or using it for common good, common movement, common push, common pressure.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're talking about over 600 various different and distinct cultures and backgrounds and it's very much less homogenized.
I just wondered if maybe like everyone temporarily could sort of come together and leverage.
Well, that's what they seem to be trying to do now, and right now is probably at as much of a fever pitch as I've ever seen it. We're to the point where we've got, you know, politicians arguing at ceremonies, and you know, fuck, the new guy came in for reconciliation in Manitoba and started talking about how residential schools had the best of intentions. And
he laughed out of the
one, I forget buddy's name, the one native guy came up right up on stage and called him out on it. So, I mean, we might be getting to that point. We just had our first Indigenous Governor General appointed here. I mean, I don't even know why we still have a fucking Governor General, but anyway, we got our first Indigenous one, so that helps. But I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
I don't know enough about it to, but it's still a step in the right direction. At least it's someone that gets a camera stuck in their face that might say something intelligent on our behalf.
Exactly. So what happened? So it wasn't just the schools, right, that had massive problems here, although you kind of focus on that, but it was just people in general. A lot of people disappearing. Like over.
Well, that's still a problem today.
Is it really?
Yeah, the missing and murdered Indigenous women. I mean, that's probably in the States too.
Yeah.
I highlight in the book some information from the United States website that talks about the stats down there, and they're pretty much identical to the numbers in Canada. I'm just going to scroll to them because I haven't done this enough to know them off heart yet. But I mean, in Canada, we've had the problem of the missing and murdered indigenous women. We've also had the problem with the Starlight Tours, which was a national inquiry into where drunk natives were being dropped off on the outskirts of town and sub-zero temperatures and subsequently freezing to death. So if we look, I'll pull up the American numbers here. From nativewomenswilderness.org, indigenous women are murdered at 10 times the rate, higher than all other ethnicities. Murder is the third leading cause of death for indigenous women, as of the CDC. More than 4 to 5 indigenous women have experienced violence. More than half of indigenous women, 56%, have experienced sexual violence. More than half of indigenous women have been physically abused by their intimate partners. Less than half of indigenous women have been stalked in their lifetime, only 48%. Indigenous women are 1.7 times more likely to experience violence, two more times more likely to be raped, and 3 times more likely to be murdered than non-indigenous Anglo-American women. And in Canada, the numbers are pretty much identical. That's sort of why I highlighted. I mean, we've got this, the Highway of Tears in Canada, where women have been just disappearing en masse. We had the, I don't know if people remember, but we had the serial killer in Canada that they found dozens of indigenous women's bodies at the pig farm in Port Coquitlam.
Ooh. What is this story that we've heard? This, I don't know, is it a rumor? Is it a real story about the Queen and Prince Philip showing up at a residential school in the 60s and disappearing with some kids? Is that true?
I don't know. I'm talking to Kevin tomorrow. I could ask him. I don't know. And for the sake of the book, I really tried to stick to stuff that was like provable.
Yeah.
And citable. The one thing that I'm super proud of in the book is the bibliography. I don't know if I sent you the full copy with the bibliography or not, but I mean, the book is short. It's got dozens and dozens and dozens of footnotes in it, plus another 50 points or so in the bibliography, all the speeches, all the legislation, right back to like, argument sessions and debate sessions in the like 1880 fucking House of Parliaments. Anything that I could track down, I did. Or Natasha did. Shout out to Natasha, who helped me with a ton of the sourcing. But it's impeccably sourced. Yeah. And anything that couldn't be proven. I mean, like I said, there's a few things in the Starlight Tours that are alleged. Anything that's alleged, I pointed to alleged. There was also a national inquiry that found them guilty and fired them. So I linked that in there as well. And I tried to keep it just like that. So to keep it very much like an encyclopedia that you can read something in here and you can say it to your friend and you don't have to worry about them saying, no, 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 because that's not going to help. That's really not going to help. And there's a couple good books in Canada out already, honestly. But they're kind of overwhelming. So I kind of wanted to keep it underwhelming.
Right.
In a good way. Where it's only, you know, it's less than 200 pages. It's very to the point.
Yes.
And impactful, I believe. So.
Yeah. I've got it open here too. The document you sent me. Yeah. You get right to it. You know, there's no once upon a time. It's just boom, you're right in. And the information that you brought in, these good Lord, there's so much in here. The excerpts from Apology for Residential Schools from the 22nd Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, on 2008. You mentioned that there are three different
there's a few apologies. There's a bunch of churches. The churches actually, a bunch of the churches started the ways. I don't have those in front of me, but I think it was as early as the late 80s or early 90s, a couple of churches apologized. Maybe the Anglican, maybe another one. The Catholic Church still hasn't apologized. The federal government apologized in 2008. Stephen Harper apologized for residential schools specifically, didn't mention one other thing, didn't mention trees or 60 scoop or anything else very specifically around residential schools. They did start the commission there. Not a ton happened. I mean, you could argue, I would say probably successfully, that Kevin Annett had a lot to do with that apology and the pressure that he was putting on behind the scenes. The fact that he's been sort of ripped apart publicly as he has, I think, lends more credence to his allegations. And the fact that they just found a bunch of graves where he said they were going to find a bunch of graves,
that helps for your credibility. Of course, it's one of those things you'd love to be wrong about.
But. So, the Catholic Church has yet to apologize. The Pope has expressed sorrow. My thought is, it's not technically, I'm stealing this from Thomas King, but I think that the Catholic Church is worried about, because they're so heavily implicated in it, I think they might be worried that a public apology could open up the door for liability.
Yeah.
And maybe financial retribution, which could be hard the way that the Catholic Church is. I mean, they're kind of set up to be insulated from that in a lot of ways, where the money kind of goes all the way up to the Vatican, but it's hard to get it back down. It's hard to get any responsibility up that way, the way they're sort of set up structurally. So we haven't seen that yet. And the Harper apology excluded some East Coast stuff, which Trudeau now picked up the slack for in 2017, finished off that apology. And then we've had three provinces, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta. I want to say 2015, Manitoba, 2018, Alberta, 2019, Saskatchewan, that have apologized specifically for what they call the 60 scoop, which is where at the low end, 20,000 kids were then scooped up after residential schools by child services and dispersed all over the country.
Jesus.
So we've had three public apologies for that. And a $750 million lawsuit was paid out. On the low end was the 20,000 kids, which, I mean, there's the high estimate of that is over 100,000.
Stolen from their home. Yeah.
So if we just say that number's 20,000, we'll take the 750 million minus the 50 million for the foundation, leaves you 700 million. $700 million divided by, let's say it's just 20,000. That'd be about 715,000 each, which wouldn't be bad. That's not the actual number. I think there's, with, by the time everything's said and done, the maximum payout's 50,000. I think it's the last time I looked into it, I think it looks like it's going to be more around 21,000 for all the people who are claiming. And the four law firms got 18.75 million each. The four law firms split 75 million, and 70,000 people split 700 million.
I think people are forgetting what this, the number is so big, the number of kids taken out of the home. Just imagine if there was a knocking at your door and the police were there right now and they were going to take your kids from you. Like, that would be the most traumatizing thing your kids ever went through, that you ever went through. You'd want to go grab a gun and start shooting people. I mean, you'd freak out. And then
good of a job are you going to be at raising kids if that happened to you and you never got to see any kids get raised except by nuns that didn't like you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the other part of the problem.
Yeah.
There's no pass down of information. Now you haven't learned how to be a parent. You've just been traumatized and traumatized and traumatized.
Yeah. It's psychotic. I mean, it is the worst thing that you could have happen. And what's the alternative, right? The police show up. So they either take your kids and put them in a home, and you might get to see them during the summer, or you might get to see them when they get to a certain age. Or the alternative is what? they just take the kids?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. This is not good.
This is not good. And this is happening, you know, the residential schools are going to say ended in the 60s or whatever, the mandatory attendance ended in the early 70s. But like the numbers I'm pulling up on suicide are from 2018 reports. And the numbers I'm using for in the book for child welfare, mm-hmm. which is, I think, 8-1. I should navigate there quick before I say that. But the numbers for child welfare in Canada are still, I think, 8-1, I want to say. 8-1 as of 2016. So as of 2016 census, 52% of the children in foster care in Canada between 0 and 14 are Indigenous.
52%.
And they only represent 7.7% of the population.
Whoa.
So it's a problem. And that's in 2016. And I would dare to say that this hasn't gotten a whole lot better by 2020. And there's a problem. I mean, there could well be a good reason for a lot of those kids to be taken out. But there's a responsibility to the culture, to the people, and to the kids to try and make this right as opposed to continuing to just rip it apart. And the government's not going to do that. I mean, the only way that's going to happen is if, you know, people like us, because I mean, I have no problem with any white people or anything. And here's the other thing. In Canada, especially, mm-hmm. no one's coming for your land. 88.9% of all the land in Canada is owned by the government.
Whoa.
They're federal or provincial. 88.9%, only 11% is privately owned, and over half of that is owned by major corporations, not private citizens.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so there's tons of fucking room. Of course, that number would include all the Indian land, which is not owned by Indians. So it's good to get that idea out of your head right away that the Indians already have this land. They don't have any land. They got some land they can borrow. They can never own. That means you don't know how secure it is for your kids. I don't know. For my grandkids, I want a fucking farm that I can pass down, you know, and pass down. So that doesn't exist in Canada right now unless you leave the reserve and go buy your own land.
Jesus.
And that's in 2021. So I think, you know, we got to just figure out a way to how we're going to fix that and hold the government accountable together instead of, because the government's going to try and make it so that the Indigenous in Canada just start pointing fingers at non-Indigenous and vice versa. And that's not going to solve any of the problems. We just need to pass the talking stick around and keep talking about shit. And sometimes it'll be easy and sometimes it'll be harder and, you know. But eventually you'll get to some sort of solution, which I have no idea. Like I say, I'm not qualified to decide what that might look like. I mean, I know what Kevin wants to do. Kevin wants to burn it all down and start with a new republic, which I fucking can't say is the worst idea in the world. It's not going to win you a lot of sympathy votes.
No.
So we're probably going to meet someplace in the middle.
Burn it halfway down.
Yeah, or take the power back, because I mean, here's the thing. I don't think the average Canadian is fucking thrilled either with the way things have turned out.
No, if ever there was a time for change, now would be the time. You've got all these leaders doing the exact opposite thing that you would want. I mean, we see in the States, we see the COVID response. We think it's bad where we are. We see that it's way worse in Australia, and it's maybe just as bad. Well, maybe not as bad, but damn close in Canada in some areas, at least what we're seeing, going after pastors and arresting kids for skating on lakes and all these things that we've seen that just went, we just go, this is authoritarian shitheadism. And the Canadians, we, in our minds, the Canadians are very polite and nice people. And we feel like, I can't believe that they're sitting around just tolerating this. And So maybe if ever there was a chance for a big major sweeping change, it would be now, because there are so many people that are unhappy with the current behavior of the government, not just in Canada, really, but around the world.
It highlights the atrocities of government and institutions.
Yes.
At a time when people seem to be trusting them a little more than they should. So I think it's a good idea to highlight some of that. Like I say, maybe it can push back on some of that. And, you know, we had a way of life here that I'm not that close to. I mean, I'm trying to get back to it, but, you know, I hunt my own meat. That's about as close as I get to my original culture, but I'm trying to learn as much as I can and as quickly as I can so that I can pass it down to my kids and try and hook that chain back together. I'm going to, you know, reaching out to some long lost sort of family relations that I haven't spoke to in a long time to try and see what I can do to patch up that chain and at least add some sort of knowledge back into that. See what we can do, because we had a way of life here that wasn't terrible. And, you know, maybe there's a way to meet that in the middle, because I would argue that after a year and a half of COVID, people have maybe realized that fucking sitting in a cubicle all day ain't that great either.
No. Yeah. It's not, people are feeling that they want to get outside and get back to a little bit more about nature, things that matter. And maybe our culture is a little bit screwed up. And then we look at some of the native cultures and think, God, I mean, I feel like they were maybe doing it way better than we were. And we came in and screwed that whole thing up. The book is called A Canadian Shame, The Ongoing Legacy of the Indian Act and Residential Schools. What's the best place for people to get it? When this goes out, it's going to be past your little free time on Amazon, but it'll...
Oh, that's all right. I did change the title there, to A Canadian Shame, The Indian Act and Residential Schools. I mean, I hope everyone could go pick it up, because here's the thing is I had two different offers. I had two different options to go with the publisher on this. Mm-hmm. And I turned them both down in the interest of self-publishing.
Yeah.
Mostly because I was looking at waiting another year at a minimum, and I'm not good at waiting. So I just did it on my own through our own sort of publishing company that we use for audiobooks and stuff like that, Adult Brain. But the book is A Canadian Shame, The Indian Act and Residential Schools. It's on Amazon.ca.com, everywhere Amazon is. If you go to acanadianshame.ca, if you hate Amazon, scroll to the bottom of acanadianshame.ca and there's a contact form there to email and get yourself a signed copy. Or if you don't want a signed copy, you can just get a copy directly from me. It costs a little more because I'm not Amazon, but you won't have to go through Amazon. And I will ship it to you directly and I can fill it out for you. It does. It's about $8 more to go through me directly, but it is an option. acanadianshame.ca. You can go there and that'll either get you to the Amazon page you need to get to, or it'll get you to the contact form to get a hold of me. And the publishing company's Adult Brain. If you want to check out adultbrain.ca, the audiobook should be out. I would say I'm hoping it'll be out maybe even before the weekend.
Oh, wow.
Canadian Shame. As narrated by Graham Dunlop. If not, it will definitely be out by Tuesday. So you'll have the audiobook available for that as well. And we've done a ton of other audiobooks you can check out. We've done Secret Teachings of All Ages, Manly P. Hall.
Cool.
Got that out on audio. We got The Secret Doctrine 1 and 2, Hamlet's Mill. The Unabomber Manifesto, a whole bunch.
Ooh, I want that one. I got to get the Unabomber Manifesto.
Yeah, if you head to adultbrain.ca, all the titles are there. You click on the take. The other thing you can do is you just head to Audible. Mm-hmm. And if you type in Grimerica, all of our books will come up. But now that Audible started doing the podcast thing, it kind of convolutes it with all the podcasts.
Oh.
What you might want to do is just type in Graham Dunlop. And all the books. Dunlop's narrated like 16 books now.
Really?
Oh yeah, dude's turning into an Audible superstar.
That's funny.
It is. He's got a real knack for it. He's really come a long ways.
That's great. And what about Grimerica? What's the best place for people to find you?
Grimerica.ca has the new website. That'll get you to the event page, to the apparel page, to the Grimerica Outlawed page. You can get everywhere from Grimerica.ca. But yeah, if you guys could buy the book, share the book, review the book, rate the book. I have zero marketing budget and I turned down publisher like a fucking idiot. So hopefully, I'm hoping all that this community can help pick up that slack and make me not regret that.
I think the self-publishing is the way to go. I've done it with my books. I talked to a publisher about it and he was asking me the difference, you know, how much are you going to make if you do it with Amazon? I told him, you know, per book, and he said, I can't compete with that. You're better off going a different route than me. So these publishers are getting kind of beaten down. So the self-publishing route is now an option. I think that's probably, you guys will probably find it's a damn good one too.
Here's hoping. Yeah, this is my first one. If it does well, I'm going to do a volume 2. There's a couple things I didn't get to in this that I'd like to sort of address. I could see it becoming 3 or 4 volumes in the end.
Well, people, you heard the man. Go out there and get your books. That's Darren Grimes from Grimerica. He's you know who he is. He's been on the show. We've been on his show. It's one big happy family. Please take the additional step of supporting our author friends here. They need our help. Buy the book for yourself. Buy it for somebody in your family that maybe you think it will have an interest in this, and send it to them. Darren, you are the best as usual. You are the better half of Grimerica. Don't tell Graham I said that. And for anyone that is interested, please take the additional step of sharing this show with the general public, because we can't count on the algorithms to do that. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Have a great time. We'll talk to you soon.